Okay, I think we are on page 141. So, chapter 3, and this is the third chapter in a series of three that make up together part 4, the children of self-love and pride. First one was envy, last week's was anger, and this one is sorrow. This is the third child of self-love and pride. Soul-raising sorrow. Joy is from Christ, sorrow is from the devil. Yolanda, I worry a lot. Why do you worry? Have all your ships sunk? Did you sail them that they should sink? In the Atlantic, do people take ships out into the ocean in such weather? How many of them sunk? And we might think that he's just being kind of humorous, but she answers in kind, Yolanda, all of them sunk. So it's not just, I mean, she probably doesn't have ships, you know, but she probably does make efforts in spiritual life, and she feels as though, she's just kind of sunk, all of her efforts. Well, now you have no possessions. And so we're back to the metaphor again. And so, you know, all your ships have sunk. You don't have any possessions. You could become a good nun. Why don't you glorify God constantly? What are you lacking? I can understand how one might be saddened that he has distanced himself from Christ, but I cannot understand how one who is close, so close to Christ, can be sad, because even if he does have pain, the pain of loss, his pain is sweetened by Christ. Poison cannot subsist in people if they bring the poison into contact with Christ. It turns into sweet syrup. If one carries the poison within, it means that he does not bring his problems to Christ. What are they talking about?
And anger, bitterness.
Could this be depression?
Well, yeah, I think it could be any of those things, but how does it make a difference that we bring those things into contact with Christ? Actually, these questions, he seems to be developing a pattern of asking questions and, you know, or saying things that he doesn't really make clear until afterward. So the next couple of paragraphs, I think, make what he means clear. But it seems to me that it's not self-evident how contact with Christ deals with these things. It's not evident, self-evident from what we've read so far, anyway. I mean, we could just be pious and say, oh, well, contact with Christ, it wipes out all these problems. But he's a lot more, he goes a lot more into detail in this book about how to deal with how things work, how spiritual life works. On the next page, page 142, he gives some background, the way we understand things as Christians. Joy is from Christ. Sorrow is from the devil. So if you're experiencing sorrow, and then later on he'll qualify that. He doesn't just flatly say joy is from Christ, sorrow is from the devil. If you're feeling sorrow, it's from the devil. Not always. Later on he'll talk about how certain kind of sorrow is not from the devil. If you've disappointed Christ, basically. Do you have any idea how it saddens me when I see a monk behaving like a grocer who has suffered losses? So how can a monastic, how can someone making spiritual effort, which can include us, of course, hopefully, be like a grocer who suffers losses? If you're a grocer, if you're a business person in the world and suffer a loss, then you're sad because as a business person, your loss means you're really in danger as far as being able to go on. He's setting up this situation in spiritual life to say that it isn't like that. I mean, you lost all your ships, you're better off because you don't have any possessions. It is, of course, quite different to have grief in God. Now, here's a different kind of grief, not grief over the loss of worldly things, but grief in God, he's saying, is different than grief that comes from the loss of worldly things. That is joyful sorrow. There is a joyful sorrow. So now, sorrow is from the devil, joy is from Christ, but there is a joyful sorrow. He's being very subtle, I think, trying to say something very particular. It is then, when you have joyful sorrow, that you rejoice. The silence, the modesty that one has, are like honey dripping into his heart, a sweetness dripping into the heart in this condition of joyful sorrow. When I see such a person, this is a holy person who experiences this, I'm ready to even kiss his feet. Okay, so there's two kinds of sorrow. One is from God, one is from the devil. Yoranda, how does one understand if his sorrow is truly of God rather than the other kind? Let's assume that one commits a sin and grieves over it. If he is grieving out of pure philotimo, that is nobility, because you are grieved because you have fallen short, betrayed Christ, and your nobility is nobility of this Christian kind, not the nobility of the ancient Greek warriors, where they fight for their own honor and for the honor that is recognized by the city. But this philotimo, this kind of honor, this Christian honor, is the nobility of Christ and the nobility of the saints. So it's not the same kind of honor. It's a Christian honor. So grieving out of pure philotimo because he is fully aware of his fall and the fact that he has grieved Christ. So you've fallen short of Christ. You've not acted along with him. You've done something that separates you from him. But here there is, he says, a sweet pain that such a person feels within himself. Because you are grieving for what you ought to grieve for, not for the loss of possessions, not for the loss of worldly honor that pleases your ego, but something completely opposite. You're grieving. This comes from a love of Christ, a love of God, not a love of worldly reputation or honor or fame in the world, but grief because you have grieved Christ. And God responds by sprinkling a sweetness, a divine consolation. It's return of the love that the grieving person feels because of their love of Christ. God sprinkles a sweetness, a divine consolation in his soul. This type of sorrow is from God, because after all, it's a turn away from pride and toward humility. The sorrow that we're dealing of, remember, is one of the children of pride and self-love. So there is an opposite way to go, and he's pointing out what that opposite way is. However, when one feels constant sorrow along with anxiety and despair, he must understand that this sorrow is not from God. Godly sorrow is actually a spiritual joy that brings consolation to the soul, while sorrow which is not godly brings anxiety and dead ends. And that's the conclusion of what he began over here on the previous page. It really is the conclusion of the first thing that he's talking about, I think. What do you think? So I guess I'm claiming that it takes closer analysis, this book, it seems to me, to get to squeeze the meaning out of it than some of his books we've read, which are very straightforward. This one, it seems to me, requires more attention, you know, more focus. I mean, it's all there, you know, but there's nothing hidden.
It almost seems like he has a twinkle in his eye in his first answer. What? Sorry, you lost all your ships?
Right, sure.
You sent them out. This is the wrong time of year to send ships out anyway, isn't it? Who sends ships out in the Atlantic this time of year?
Right.
And then, you know, she's answering, and it seems to me that she's like, all of them is sunk.
She picks
she
up.
She doesn't mean her ships. She means everything I keep trying to do. I'm
right.
Not fasting like I should. Whatever her thing that she's that happens to be bothering her is all falling through.
Oh. And there's a close comparison, too, because if that's what she's doing, she is kind of acting like a merchant, you know, relying on herself. Self-reliance, I've been trying to do this, it's not working out, everything is failing, and he's telling her, be joyful about it, because you've lost all that effort, that self-reliant effort that you've made. All of it's come to nothing. this is a good thing, you know, welcome to the life of a nun, of a monk, of a Christian making a spiritual effort.
That does, it took me a, you know, the thing about a grocer took me a few minutes, you know, he said something about, you know, I don't like to see a monk that acts like he's alone. It saddens me when I see a monk behaving like a grocer who has suffered losses. Well, it's because whenever you see St. Paisios suffering loss, he rejoices in it. When a grocer, or some merchant, you know, somebody like me loses money in whatever we're trying to do, we've lost money. But he sees, oh, good, I've lost, because so now I'm in the spiritual. He has, you know, he's looking at the things spiritually.
I think it's important to recognize that he's not invalidating the situation of the grocer.
No. He's just saying monks.
He's using that as, like, as Jesus will do. He'll assume people understand the way of the world, and he'll take an example from the way of the world, and you'll use it to explain something spiritual. It doesn't mean that what he said about the world is invalid at a worldly level. It is valid, you know, at a worldly level. As a matter of fact, if it weren't, it wouldn't be any use either to Jesus or Elder Paisios to explain what he wants to explain. Sometimes people make an opposition, you know, where there isn't really an opposition.
Well, and any grocer that continued to go down the path of making losses wouldn't be a grocer very long. You know, he has to make a little money to stay in business. But what he's saying is, look, you're not a grocer, you're a follower. In this case, you're a monk, you've lost, that's good. This is a good place for you to start. It seems to me that that's what I'm reading between the lines, maybe.
You've
lost, now you're down to where you need to be, you're down to nothing, and you can start being a good nun, Jesus, a good monastic. And I think, you know, I try to fill in Christian, even though I'm not a monk.
No, it's the same spiritual realities for all of us.
And the loss for me, though, Father, spiritually speaking, if see if this is, losses for me that I've experienced have been that I used to really worry about and what I've lost have to do with really loss of ego. Things that, oh, people are going to think this about me or think that, or oh, now look, I've sinned and I'm concerned. I wish that I had the sorrow he's talking about, where I'm really sorry that I've hurt Christ. But what I'm sorry about, many times I've been sorry about, is, oh no, now people are going to find out what it's really like. And you know, this image I've been trying to burnish and it has been seen through, and now, you know, I've fallen in this way, and now look what things are. Rather than rejoicing that, okay, now you don't have to keep up with that image anymore. You can eventually, we'll get down to something that has to do with reality, Jimmy. You know, I think that maybe this sort of loss, that maybe that's what I'm reading between the lines, for me at least, that I'm hearing. He talks a lot about egoism, and it's, for me, he has simplified so many things. St. Paisios says, oh, that's just egoism. And I wish I could see a way to say, well, it could be something more, it's not that complicated. It's garden variety. It's, you know, I think my particular sins and struggles are somehow, you know, special. But the reality is, they're garden variety. Because St. Paisios, whom I've never met, knows about them. You know, and I can see what he's talking about.
Right. Right. He talks about reputation in the next couple of paragraphs, as a matter of fact. When a spiritual person, Garanda, what happens when a spiritual person worries because some heretic uses his name and brings harm to people? And they were, during his lifetime, St. Paisios had this happen to him. Because he was in such an authority, you could name drop Elder Paisios and claim, well, he thinks this, you know, and then people run with it. It's absolute. His reputation has a life of its own. And she's asking, what happens when someone uses the name of a spiritual person and brings harm to people? Yeah, in fact, it says in the footnote, which I didn't read, the sister who asked this question had in mind the occasions when people used the name of the elder and took advantage of it to benefit themselves or to convince people of their own views, their own erroneous views, by using him as an authority. This kind of affliction is justified, and one should indeed worry over it because many people are harmed, but he's worried because of the harm harm that's done by misusing his name and reputation. But even a case like this must be faced in a spiritual manner. If one positions himself humbly and says, "My God, I do not wish any harm to come to these people, enlighten them to understand the truth," and it's like Christ on the cross, you know, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." I mean, he's praying not just for the people who are harmed by someone misusing his name, he's also even praying for the people who are misusing his name. And if you pray like this, you'll be at peace, because you'll be in the proper relationship to what's going on, instead of getting all upset about your public reputation. "Gee, I've worked so hard to become a great spiritual elder. Everybody knows my name, and here they are messing it all up." That's not the way he thinks. If he begins agonizing over it and saying, "What am I to do? They're using my name, and souls are being destroyed," and so forth, he will have no peace. In any case, when one is not at fault and his conscience is at peace, that's critical. Then, even when others harm him, he feels great consolation within himself. Egoism always leads to sorrow and anxiety. "Gironda, I am constantly thinking of how my mistake grieved you, and I am overcome with sorrow." Do not think of it. It will only grieve you. It's already happened. Let it go. It's water under the bridge. It will be of no help to you to think of it. It's past. Be watchful in the future. That's what will benefit you. With Philotimo, continue your struggle. We're in this together. We're trying to act with the nobility of Christ and be faithful to him. All of us make mistakes, but the good God protects us like a father. This is why he has his saints. This is why he has a special angel assigned to protect each person. This is why he also has spiritual people, all to assist others. Well, I can't read this now without thinking of Archbishop Alexander's Mystagogy, because this is a major point, is made one of my favorite points in his writing on Dionysius the Areopagite, has to do with angels, you know, and we don't think much about them. I think one of the reasons that we don't talk much about angels, and I want to do some talking about angels in sermons soon, I think we avoid it because we have so many unhelpful ideas about angels in our society, unrealistic ideas about them. Non-physical spiritual beings, angelic beings, in all of their ranks, all the ranks of angels, the lowest rank of angels are the angels that come to us and have as their task, their responsibility, to try to enlighten us, because Dionysius emphasizes that each rank of angelic beings enlightens the rank below them. Enlightens the rank below them. And that goes all the way down till you get down to the lowest rank of angels, and it is their task to try to intervene and encourage us, enlighten us. Some people mistake it for the presence of God, the voice of God, and just, of course, then, you know, it degenerates into the typical cartoon, you know, with the, you know, good angel on one shoulder and a bad angel on the other, but there is a reality like that. So, you know, this is why there are saints and the angels. What does it mean when he says this is why they are saints? It's because none of us is a Christian alone. Each one of us is a Christian in relationship to all of the other Christians that have ever been, beginning with the Theotokos, the apostles, as I was trying to say last week, all the way down. We're not on our own. It's not up to me to be a good person by myself. It's up to me not to turn aside from the cloud of witnesses, but to be among them and be strengthened by Christ through all of them in a life where I act in concert, in harmony with all of those, all of the ones that are all of the good and the holy. I am not going to ever become holy myself on my own. Any holiness that I have, or Elder Paisios had, is because of his relationship to God through Christ, through the Theotokos, through the apostles, through all the other saints, through all the elders down through time. It's a communion, a community of the holy who love God, who are holy because they love God. And the enemy will try to keep dragging us away into egoism and self-orientation and self-love. And when we grieve over those occasions, when we move in that direction, that is a repentance and a return to the communion of saints, a reorientation toward Christ. So we all make mistakes, but God protects us like a father. He has saints. He has a special angel assigned to protect each person. This is why he also has spiritual people, even living in this world, all to assist others. So that we're always one amongst the others. Yolanda, I give in to worrying about my faults and become weary in my struggle. My. This is the problem. I give in to worrying about my faults. I'm separating myself already, making an effort on my own, and become weary in my struggle, mein Kampf, you know, my struggle. This is due to your egoism. Since you do not give in, you end up giving out. Self-reliance is present here. Humility, repentance, contrition are not present. Egoism is present, and egoism always leads to sorrow and anxiety, the bad kind of sorrow. When a person has no repentance but instead worries out of egoism over how he appears to others because he fell in their estimation, then within him there is agony, bitterness, and pain. So there it is, the confirmation of what of the point that Jimmy was making just a minute ago.
Not exactly the sort of confirmation I was looking for, but yes.
Well, total peace, just after all.
Yes. I was actually thinking the same thing. I highlighted it today.
Right. Well, you need more colors.
Oh, I just highlighted that today. Well, I highlighted another thing later.
Okay.
But yeah, just
the
blue.
The reason I find is that it's the same thing for all of us. I mean, in so many ways, it's the same thing.
Well, isn't that nice that we have kind of togetherness? So there's a wrong kind of togetherness. It can be very powerful and scary. People can want it, you know.
I do have yellow and pink highlighters that I didn't bring out today.
That's okay.
You know your own code. Maybe blue is the most important.
Could be, yeah.
If I highlight anything, it's just something I needed to highlight. Because I don't highlight so much, but I probably should, but maybe.
No, that's good.
And now here he's going to get subtle on us again. In other words, Yolanda, does being overly distressed after one has fallen always stem from egoism? Always stem from egoism? Top of 144. Not always. It can also stem from philotimo. When the distress is great and comes only from pure philotimo, love of the struggle along with Christ, then the divine consolation is also great and strong, strengthening not only the soul, but also the body. Similar question to the last one. We were here at this point before in a different explanation. How will I understand whether my sorrow stems from philotimo, the good or bad kind of sorrow? Whoever grieves out of philotimo places the weight of responsibility upon himself. Whoever grieves out of egoism places the weight of responsibility on others and claims that he is the one being wronged. His ego is injured. He gives the example of two sisters. Both did something that was damaging. He spoke to both of them. They were both sorry, hung their heads, but one was sorry out of philotimo, and the other was sorry because her ego had been injured. The first was too ashamed even to look at me. The other, not wanting to lose her reputation, went on to justify herself without examining the extent of the damage. The damage is not important, you know, to this sister. She only thought, I have fallen in the estimation of others, made me look bad. How can I justify my mistake so that I will not lose my reputation? I want everyone to accept this version of things that keeps my reputation intact. She tried to justify herself, which is why she had no peace. That's how you can tell. A couple of very clear ways to tell. Do you place the responsibility on yourself or on others? Do you try to justify yourself? Are you at peace? If you're not, and you want to claim that you are innocent and you were injured and you were the one wronged, then it's not fellow timon. Something else. When we take all the weight of responsibility upon ourselves, then God himself will lift that weight off of us. Because we're doing something that is similar to what he did on the cross. Self-emptying, taking the responsibility for whatever it is, not worrying about it was the fault of the person who accused me or you know, defending me. I mean, Christ could have, if he had defended himself and not gone to the cross, why should I go to the cross and suffer this? Well, that's because that's why you come into the world. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all. You know, it would have been a rejection of everyone. And it is a rejection of everyone. Either we do as he did, or we reject everyone, blame everyone, and defend ourselves. Those are the two alternatives. We should therefore decide which of the two we will choose. Humility, which provides peace, or egoism, which brings worry, anxiety, and agitation. Children of self-love and pride, remember, is what we're talking about. And this is the third one, sorrow. Clear? Too clear. Page 145. Okay, Garanda, why is it that many people of everything feel anxious and worried? When you see a person who lacks nothing but has great anxiety, distress, and sorrow, you can be sure that he lacks God. He who has everything, both material possessions and physical health, who instead of being grateful to God makes irrational demands and complaints, is already shod for hell. The grateful person is pleased with everything. He acknowledges what God provides for him every day and enjoys everything. But when one is ungrateful, he is not pleased with anything. And when I reread this, it sounded familiar to me because it was St. Nikolai.
Velimirovich.
Yeah, no. Velimirovich. Velimirovich. I practiced.
Thank you. And if a Russian man says it, I'm not.
Yeah, it's not Russian. That's the thing.
Oh, is it?
It's not Russian. And if a Russian man says it, it might be that way.
Well, but if he says Russian. It, I don't understand what he's saying, and I have to listen. Oh,
they say it
doesn't
really
sound
fast.
Like either one of the things we said.
They do it up at the monastery.
It's not. What is it?
It's Velimirovich.
No, but it's not Russian, you said.
No, it isn't. It wasn't Russian.
This reminds me of a little old lady that we used to go see, Sherry. I don't know if you ever got to go see her with me, because it was after high school, but before. I think we might have gone to see her in the nursing home. This little old lady was a lady that went to my church. She had to have help breathing. She lived in a nursing home. She was so frail that, you know, if you squeezed her too hard, if you gave her a hug, you could break her bones. She was very, very frail. If she fell, she'd break something. She was no longer Miss Hazel. Anyway, she was went to church with me when I was a child at the Christian Missionary Alliance Church. But she was in this place, which I think of those places as terrible places. You know, you go there and there's this collection of old people that have kind of been abandoned, and they're there. But I would go there thinking I'm going to encourage her, and I would leave so encouraged. And she was sitting there. You know, physically, she didn't have a lot to be grateful for. I mean, if we just look at it from our own eyes. But she would say the Psalms to me. She had memorized some of the Psalms, and she would repeat the Psalms, and she was full of joy. Like when I met Father, I saw a picture of Father Thomas with him on Facebook at his grave, Thomas Hopko. When I met him, I told someone, I really can't tell you what it is about him. He said things that were wonderful things, but that's not what it was about him. There was something very like being around Christ, it seemed to me, being around Father Thomas Hopko, and not necessarily anything in particular he said, just his presence. And it had to do with a lot more than that. But the way that she was like that, I would leave and be full of joy. And this is when I was 17, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old. And what a wonderful, and she was thankful for all these people are the sweetest people. this is my nurse. Jimmy, I want you to meet my nurse. She is so sweet. And she'd tell me something about her children, her nurse's children. And this poor lady, this is a nurse that's coming in, changing things, and she hasn't done anything special for her, probably, just beyond her job. But people probably wanted to do special things for her, but she never, I'm just so reminded of her that she didn't have anything going, you know, in a wonderful way for her physically.
So gratitude.
Yes, and she was one of the most joyful people that that I ever met.
I know someone that is very young, you know, very nice body, nice car, but he always seems to be down and out. But do you think that could be like a mental, other than being ungrateful to what he has from God?
Well, when you say mental, and we're talking in this kind of spiritual effort context, the first thing I think of is Dee Pennock's book, with the title of which was what?
God's path to sanity.
So the traditional or orthodox spiritual perspective is that if you are not as we are meant to be, it's a condition of spiritual insanity to be completely involved in the love of the things of the world, the love of yourself, the forgetfulness of God. Everything is out of whack in such a person, because human beings are created to be in communion with God, to be at one with one another, to turn aside from what is wrong and what is evil. If you love things that are not good and you think that you are the center of everything and everyone else is potentially an enemy, there's a spiritual insanity there. So if we're in, the question you're asking, I think, would be more like, is this person mentally unbalanced from a secular point of view?
Yeah.
That would be a different question.
Okay.
So it's good for us to remember that we're probably all.
Well, those are all, that's all matter of amplitude. You know, we're a certain amount of crazy. How far are we down that, you know, path, it seems like, you know?
If you're crazy in a secular sense, it means you're not functional in a secular sense. But you could be functional in a secular sense, and Dee Pennock would still count you among those who are spiritually insane.
And you could be spiritually
healthy.
So
there's a context. The context is different.
You could be spiritually healthy and have your spiritual values correct, and people would think you were a nut.
That's right. And you would, as far as the world is concerned, as Sharon says, a fool for Christ.
Right.
Who is definitely mentally unbalanced. And yet at the same time, they are as they are meant to be in relationship to God and the saints. So are they sane or insane? Depends on your point of view.
Okay.
On your context, you would say, I guess, would be not so much point of view. Yeah, point of view, but what, by point of view in this case, we mean your the context, a sacred context of how we are meant to be in relationship to God, or the context of secular functionality. Are you making it? Are you able to deal with the fallen world in an effective way? Some people can't.
People fall, a lot of people fall in the habit of never being satisfied with what they have.
Which,
you know, or never being, as you say, grateful for what you have. They're always looking at something or somebody else and seeing that they don't have as good of. So he's being probably lots of times envious and jealous of everyone else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have this nice car and this beautiful, you know, and I'm good looking, but I don't get as many girlfriends as this guy over here, or I don't.
And it's just a monster that is never satisfied.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you could have,
but you can fall into that
the
habit.
The nicest car that anybody, but you don't always think there's something better.
Any one of the negative, any one of the passions. Remember, passions can be, they all have a purpose. But if it's a negative passion, it will be bottomless, because it's going to seek something for which there is no fulfillment. You know.
An itch you can't scratch, kind of thing.
Well, you can scratch it.
Stop itching.
You may bleed to death.
Poison ivy.
We'll never be satisfied.
No.
Mm.
bottom of 145, Gironda, can grumbling be a habit? Why does she even ask?
Yeah, that's what we just talked about there, right?
It becomes a habit because and the because is important, is what we're talking about. Grumbling brings on more grumbling. One misfortune brings on another misfortune. Whoever sows misfortune will harvest misfortune. He is stockpiling anxiety. Then he returns in the next paragraph to ungratefulness. Ungratefulness is a great sin which Christ censured. Something interesting he does here. He refers to when Jesus says, were there not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Referring to those who are cured of leprosy. This is what Christ asked of the leper who returned to thank him for healing him. Christ expected gratitude from the 10 lepers, not for himself, but for themselves. Gratefulness would have benefited them. Not for himself. It's not like God expects us to be grateful. You hear sermons like that. I hope you don't hear one from me, because I would have forgotten how things are. I'm not saying that I'm beyond that, but if you do hear it from me, say, well, Father Jacobs is, you know, he's fallen into some kind of non-orthodox condition this week, because it's not that God wants our gratitude. He knows that we need to be grateful in order to be in relationship to him in such a way that we will gain life from his life, and that ungratefulness, lack of gratitude, is going to affect us negatively. We have to be turned away from God to be ungrateful, you know. So this is something that you might not necessarily have expected Elder Paisios to say. Look at the incredible insight that he has saying that.
What does that mean for us, Father? I wonder what that means when I notice, like, for instance, I'll do something for one of my children, well, it means say thank you. But that's not what Christ is doing. I'm not Christ with the lepers. Well, there were 10, but I mean, I think maybe I shouldn't open ask this an open question.
That's what happens.
But I just realized.
We all say that every once in a while about anything.
I'm in the place here of realizing that that's not a Christ-like thing to recognize the unthankfulness of someone for.
I deserve gratitude.
And you're saying that is not what God is saying.
No.
For his own. Then of course he doesn't need anything from us.
No, but he also needs for us to be like him. You could say it that way, because of his love. No, I can't say that about my kids, mainly because I am a limited, specific, particular, created being. So the best thing for my kids is not necessarily to be like me. I mean, you know, the things that are most painful to me is when I see some quality of mine in my children tearing up their life. So the object is not for them to be like me. It's bad enough that I'm like me. And, you know, they are, thank goodness, you know, they're half Sharon and other relatives that aren't culps, and they have to deal with whatever it is they have to deal with. But it's not being like me. That's not what they have to deal with. I have to deal with that. God help me. You know, and each one of us is in that kind of condition. But with God, being that he is God, the uncreated Holy One, you know, who has created us and given us the opportunity to be fulfilled, joyful, holy, with his holiness, you know, ingratitude is going to keep us from any of that. Turn us toward ourselves, turn us toward selfishness, turn our back on him and reality, fantasies instead, wanting to be at the top of the pyramid, you know, instead of being part of the hierarchy of all things related to him. It all fits together. It is remarkable.
It's not like he needs our gratitude in order for some. I'm thinking of this some movie I saw. There's two or three of them that have to do with Christmas that are, you know, and Christmas spirit is lost. Well, you can't get the sled off the ground because Santa Claus doesn't have enough power now because everybody doesn't love him enough.
Right.
And it's not like that. God needs our love in this way. I don't know that I thought that, but just thinking about it openly, well, that's not, that's, and he's saying, he doesn't need that armor. It's not for him.
No, God is not anything like Santa Claus.
But
St. Nicholas is like Christ.
Right. More than one of them. Buddy the Elf is one of them, yeah. Very interesting.
You don't have to be Orthodox long to figure out that God isn't like Santa Claus, I think.
Yes. That's true.
He wouldn't give us so many things we don't want. The devil wants to see us sad. Yolanda, why do I have mood swings? Abrupt. I've known her a long time.
There's nothing a recording.
Long, long time. You know, no problem. The mood swings, don't worry about it. You know, I'm okay with it, right?
As though you don't have kind of swings.
No. As the constant, you know, person that I am.
Uh-huh.
Mood swings. Abruptly shifting from joy to sorrow is often caused by temptation. Now, that to me is not obvious how that works. With malice, the devil will wage battle against people, especially those who are sensitive and joyful by nature and desire to live a spiritual life. This is the devil's work. He wants to see us in sorrow so he may rejoice. Why should we allow the devil to do his work? Is joy not better than sorrow? Is love not better than malice? There's got to be a how-to coming here, hopefully. Rhonda, at certain times I fall into sadness without knowing why. The devil doesn't want anyone to be happy. He finds ways to cause everyone worry. Okay. Both those who have reason to worry and those who do not. Okay. Do we have cause for worry or don't we? What I see in your situation is he entangles you by using fine threads. So not strong threads of real cause for worry, but just worry kind of almost for its own sake, these gossamer threads of worry. If we were using twine to entangle you, if you had real things to worry about, then I would have said that you were partly justified, and then it would be a question of how to deal with it. You, however, see these fine threads as twine, and so you worry. You think you're bound by these things, and you're not. We can be lost in worry and not really have any real cause to worry. Don't torment yourself without reason. You give joy to the devil and sadness to Christ. Do you want Christ to be sad? No, Hiranda, but there is no but. And then he quotes Chrysostom's sermon from Pascha. Christ is risen. Hades has been embittered. Just say, indeed he has been embittered. The devil has been embittered because Christ is risen. So there is reason for joy, not sadness. So he is recommending that you counter this worry that is not justified by recognizing that death itself has been overcome. And so these threads, these little webs of deceitful worry that is so much like fear of death when there's nothing to be afraid of, remember Christ is risen, that hell is abolished. The devil has no power.
This sounds like what's happening right now. With all the
politics.
No, with all the hurricanes and stuff, people are like anxious and very worried about people who've been harmed by that. You know, a lot of my friends and stuff. People are saying, I wish there was something we could do for these people that have been hurt by this hurricane. You know, there you are.
Well, I don't think those are gossamer threads.
These are things that we're not hurting. We're not in pain. We're not in
the middle of that.
In the middle of that.
Right,
and, you know, so, and there's nothing really we can do about it. It's just gossamer threads of worry.
You can't pray for people in the path of the hurricane.
Yeah.
There are a lot of little places that I can see where in life where little things start bugging you. For instance, you think you need a new car. It's because, you know, you have a tear in the seat and now and then you have to put some of this in and you have a dent over here. And pretty soon you think you're driving a piece of junk. Now, this isn't exactly the same thing, but you have the same feeling like, oh, this is such a junky car. And that's why somebody gave me advice long time. Keep up with little things and you won't feel that way. But maybe there's a spiritual lesson there too, but you know, little things can make us feel like everything is
is going bad and everything is not right.
I heard on the radio one time that the average person who was, this is back in the 80s, average person at that time that was signing bankruptcy papers didn't owe any more than $10,000. But what they were doing was they had a whole bunch of little loans, and it just felt like too much that bothered them, and so it was easier to, and all this worried them to death, so they wanted to get out of it. Little things like that. I wonder spiritually, you know, what kinds of things were, you know, he's talking about there. You think, Father, he's talking about our sins? He's talking, what sort of things do you think he's talking about with it?
About what?
Sort of gossamer threads could be, I mean, he's...
Whether you have a realistic cause for worry or not. I mean, the examples that we're coming up with are practical examples about the world. I don't know that Elder Paisios would, he might use those as an examples, but right. Might be more concerned about, let's see, somewhere soon he's going to get to, on page 150, he'll say, do not overly scrutinize. You know, you could be looking for things to worry about. You could be so scrupulously scrutinizing everything that you find, well, this is out of place, that's out of place, everything's out of place, you know, there's the things that basically don't matter, that are not critical, they're not going to sink the ship.
Right.
But worry for its own sake is something that we can become involved in if we're not in a state where we can feel good about ourselves. Is it real cause for worry, or isn't it? So there's a kind of maybe an agreement between a situation where it really isn't a real cause for worry at a practical level, and it also isn't a real cause for worry at a spiritual level. But because of self-concern, we can become involved in worrying over things both of a practical and a spiritual nature that are completely unrealistic. So I think it kind of applies to both of those.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people are, how are you doing? Well, they tell me a whole bunch of things. And sometimes what I want to say is, well, you just described the day of an adult, you know, an adult person. You know, something went wrong with their car. And, see you, buddy.
See ya.
You know, something went wrong with the car and the alarm didn't go off and they ran out of milk and seven or eight, no, don't look at Sherry, I'm not pointing Sherry out.
No, I'm not.
You looked at her like, is he talking about you? I'm not talking about her specifically, but I'm just saying all of us can, and sometimes, you know, and sometimes I, depending on my particular situation, if I were to write the things down, look at what am I worried about, well, these are just things that happen to everybody. I feel something like I'm singled out, like bad things have happened. Well, I got a speeding ticket. Well, you were speeding.
Well, I didn't.
I didn't get one.
Bad things are not supposed to happen to me.
Yes, there's something. Oh, that's their self-love and egoism coming into it, isn't it? If we start feeling that way.
I'm above that sort of bad stuff happening.
Right.
How dare does God let these bad things happen to me? Boy, this is not an Orthodox mind. Because we know as Orthodox, we can, well, St. Paul says, and I think it's in everybody's Bible, that if you're not suffering, you're not a Christian. I don't know what they do with that, but it probably, we can like blame it on all the other people that make us suffer. That would be a good tactic, I think. You know, that would be a good thing to do with it in order to maintain a non-Orthodox perspective, if you see what I mean.
Is it the Proverbs that says that God makes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust? It's the same sort of idea. Depending on whether you're in Houston or you're in Arizona, you know, rain can seem like a good thing right now.
Yeah. In the next section, he talks about the kind of, it's related to what we've been discussing, I think. Sorrow exhausts the power of both the body and the soul. We can sit and have a conversation with our own thoughts and everything appears black to you. It has nothing to do with the reality of things. We need to refocus and orient ourselves to forget about ourselves. So you torment yourself without reason, shatter yourself mentally and physically. It's only natural that your stomach would hurt after such a trauma. Mm-hmm. Although you could take something for the stomach ache to go away, if the worries don't go away, the pain will come back. Accepting thoughts that dishearten you renders useless the gifts that God has given you. You may be surrounded by gifts, but you're all self-involved in this worry. The more you settle your thoughts, the more serene and calm you'll be, and the more your health will improve. And I have a note here, careful, because of the next words, you will not need medication. Now that doesn't mean that, okay, we're going to be what are the Christian scientists, no medication, it's up to God. You know, that's not what he's saying. That's not what he's saying at all.
I think this is another case, Father Jacob, where he is specifically talking to this particular person, and this may be something that sometimes we have to deal with, but, you know, in her particular case, he's saying, look, you know, you worry about too many things, and that's why you have stomach aches, probably. And I don't know that we can say that everybody who has stomach aches because they worry about. I don't think we can extrapolate that.
No.
And also, he's a saint, Saint Pacius. Often saints know things about people that doctors don't.
Yeah. About like why they have a stomach ache.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with you. Again, if you need medication, you take it. You're humbly, you know. So we have to be careful about that. Now, here's a reoccurrence of a term that we'll probably have to go back to because we talked about it in the past, and my notes seem to have fallen out of my book.
Fretting?
No, Leventia.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know where it's that piece
over
of paper
on the,
is?
It's at home on the floor.
It's supposed to be right there.
You saw it.
Where I put it. You borrowed it.
It just kind of jumped right out when I opened
it. I don't have it. Well, then you'll have to remember the explanation.
I don't. I didn't look at it, so I have no idea.
Well, you were here when we talked about it, though.
Yeah, and I don't remember it.
Garanda, when one difficulty after another comes upon me during my... I can remember it. When one difficulty after another comes upon me during my struggle, I groan and am seized by sorrow. This cascades of difficulties. This, when the snow comes down the mountain?
Avalanche of
sorrows. It is precisely during difficult times that the strength of a person can be seen. Do not be afraid. Do not panic when you encounter some difficulty. Ask God to grant you spiritual manliness, and there it is again, to face the difficulties in your spiritual journey with fortitude and to struggle with Leventia. Leventia is another one of those terms that Otto Paisios is fond of, like Philotimo. And when we came upon it quite some time back. In fact, I have notes, see page 125, and notes. No notes, but I do have page 125. And 125, where it first came up, was having to do with the poison of envy. Envy poisons the abundant love of a woman. And Elder Paisios claims that women by nature have an abundance of goodness and love. And for that reason, the devil attacks women more. He tosses venomous jealousy at women, and women struggle with jealousy, according to Elder Paisios. Once her love is poisoned and becomes malevolent, a wicked love, maybe selfish, or you know, kind of withholding, strangling the well-being of her children, which is unnatural. Instead of being a bee gathering light and honey, a woman becomes a hornet and exceeds the grit of a man, stinging hornet. I have become very fearful of malevolence, which, when coupled with jealousy and stubbornness, can reach demonic levels. At that point, people don't even regard God and become little devils in themselves. Not only do they torment others, they torment themselves as well, and will continue to do so eternally, God forbid, unless they get rid of envy. A woman ought to be especially careful about envy. She must remove her own self from her love in order to keep her abundant love pure. So that's all Elder Paisios. How can this be done, Yoranda? It can be done by rising above the daily trifles and cultivating Leventia and spiritual nobility, a sense of sacrifice. Now, Leventia, the antidote for envy, is spiritual nobility, but unfortunately there are few who possess it. Leventia is a term which in Greek society is ordinarily used to describe a young boy, and you know, even a pre-adolescent young boy. This comes up in another, in fact, the top of the next page with a different term. Someone who is a young boy who is, you just can't keep them down. Bad things happen to them, they bounce back. you know, they just seem like they're unaffected by all the terrible things that may happen to them. They have the kind of spirit that just comes back and charges on and deals with, you know, whatever needs to be dealt with fortitude and struggling with Leventia. That's what Leventia refers to. And according to Elder Paisios, Leventia is what women need in order to contradict envy. You just deal with things at hand that are actual, you know, instead of being in this fog of envy of others, which is unrealistic. So that's what he says. Deal with your difficulties in your spiritual journey with fortitude and struggle with Leventia. And then he will say more. Look, nun, you're not where you used to be. You know, you've made some progress, glory to God, but neither are you where you should be. I do believe that you will, he's going to encourage her very strongly, I do believe that you will soon demonstrate your palikaria. Okay, palikaria. What is palikaria? Well, I looked it up. Very similar to Leventia in a way. Quality of a young, stout-hearted, tough young Greek man. A young Greek man before adolescence, unmarried, best possible soldier material, brave, valiant, courageous, daring. You know, we'll just run right into it and damn the obstacles. This is what he is encouraging her to be like. Break free of the bonds of misery. As a lion cuts through the webs of a spider, drive out misery with spiritual Leventia. I am waiting, praying, and hoping to see your progress, and I will be very happy. So that's his drive out misery with spiritual Leventia. This on the heels of letting us know how to deal with mood swings. So a spiritual take charge attitude at a spiritual level. It reminds me of, I hesitate to mention, another thing that I will not mention.
That was a good hesitation there.
Yeah.
I think with young men and just how what you're describing, Palikaria and Leventia, how sometimes they can actually harm themselves, but because they don't hold back. You know what I mean? Like they think they're indestructible as almost. And so I wonder if.
In this,
or they don't have any category.
That's true, but in this case, remember, they are not acting in an impractical way in the world. They are acting in this way within their spiritual life, and God will respond. He will protect them. Mm-hmm. You know, He will. They will be able to move from glory to glory. You know, there's nothing stopping them.
Right.
Outside of one fear.
In the spiritual
right.
way that they're outside of fear.
So that's why he's
fear.
Saying
they're fearless. That's part of it.
They don't think anything bad. I mean, they just
right.
And the opposite is what stops us.
You've hit the nail on the head there. Because
I think so.
In the case of those young men running into battle, and a lot of them end up very surprised they got a spear through their head or neck or arm or whatever, some of them actually make it through. But if they're going, you know,
in the spiritual.
Like David did, because God said, go and do this, well, you can't lose. Mm-hmm. You can go. And what he's saying is, you know, I think what St. Paisios has to say is that, you know, follow Christ with that kind of spirit and
really, they're if you know anybody like that, it's almost like they're just so full of life is mm-hmm. another way I would describe
right.
it. And so, just to, I think, to be that way, it's life-giving. You would be full of life, not because of yourself, not
right.
because you're relying on yourself, but just because you're...
You're tapping into
in a godly
the ultimate
spirit.
Source of
yeah. I think of Gonzo.
When I was young, I was a little like
Gonzo. Gonzo and the Muppets. Have you ever watched the Muppets?
Not in a while.
Well, Gonzo, isn't he the one with the big?
Yep.
He's little and. But anything can happen.
He loves the aviator, right? He has aviator glasses or something.
Sometimes he does. Yes.
Well,
yes.
I think one of the scenes,
the Great Gonzo.
He has chicken
he was holding
a whole bunch of helium balloons. Well, he's not very big, so he starts floating off away from everybody. And he makes comments that are just, they will crack you up. He'll say, oh, you know, it's not that he's not negative. He's total positive beyond reality. I mean, he's just, it's very funny. Like, oh, the sky is beautifully clear. I mean, he doesn't even see that he's floating away from everybody, you know. He just...
He's a positive attitude.
Very, to the extreme.
I just remember him. He jumped in front of a taxi one time and it stopped. And everybody's going, great job, Gonzo, great job. You got a taxi for us. Yeah, it's great when it works, he says. I thought that was kind of funny.
Well, Father Jacob, when I was young, I had a feeling like... that I could be helpful to people who are beside the road, and I would pick them up and tell them about Christ, and they'd be hitchhiking. People would say, well, man, what are you worried? I said, I'm not worried about it, because I think God wants me to stop and talk to these people. And, you know, like Gonzo said, it's great when it works. I didn't get killed or anything, and I talked to a lot of people, and I had somebody steal it. I was sleeping back from me one time, and, you know, some great things like that happened. But it was... one guy ended up taken to the hospital, and they had four guys come and get him, and they couldn't hold him down. I said, "What? He's a skinny guy. They said, don't go close to him. He was on some kind of drug that made him super strong, meth or something. And I had taken him out, gotten him some food, and he was started talking crazy. I was saying, okay, sure, and I was saying, whatever, you want to agree with him, took him to the emergency room. That guy evidently could have really messed me up. But I think that God protected me in those situations. Mm-hmm. Then when I got a family, I felt like, well, maybe I'd have Sherry with me, I wouldn't pick people up anymore. I stopped doing it because I didn't know how far that grace went. whether I was supposed to still.
I kind of have that young
little adventure back then. I wasn't Greek.
I think the book is entirely devoted to how we deal with things within ourselves. However, there is that.
Yes.
Okay, it's 7:30. So we can pick up there next time. Page 149. I made a mark.